Mr. Guthrie, reel three.
I think it was probably her papers, her briefcase, I don't know what it was, but she bent down to pick it up, and the other people who were nearby at the end of the gangplank bent down, and there was a blockage. And I said to myself, this is the moment I go down. So I slipped in and went down the gangplank, and as I suspected would happen, everybody was far more interested in helping this lady pick up her briefcase or her papers or whatever than in seeing who was coming down. And I slipped off the end of the gangplank onto the quay. And then I looked around to see where I was and what happened next. And I saw that I was, there had been, they'd made a passage, so to speak, with barriers, portable barriers, which they'd put up, through which one would have to go to get off the, get away from the ship completely. And on each side there were, I think, four military policemen standing watching who went out. And the people went off and went through the this passage that had been made with the barriers were either people off the ship who had some kind of document to show that they'd been through customs because they were checking the customs as they came off, or they were staff people and they had a pass or a thing on their lapel or something. They could all identify themselves, and of course I was not in a position to identify myself in that way. So I walked up and down trying to look as if I was waiting for someone to come off the ship and join me. Ben was there, but he wasn't in a hurry to come off because he had nowhere to go, and I think he was saying goodbye to other friends and so on. And then there came a moment when I said to myself, I can't go on walking up and down. They'll be a bit suspicious about this chap. So I walked, put my hat on the back of my head, and walked through the barriers, through this passage made by the barriers, past the policeman, trying to look as if I did this every day of my life and that I was part of the local set up, and I walked on and on and on down towards the end of the jetty. That's the end, far the land end of the jetty, expecting every moment for someone to shout behind me, hey, what are you doing? Who are you? Why have you gone through? Nobody paid any attention. And at the end, there was the street was there, and there was a taxi, and I got in it. And I said to the driver, take me to Manhattan, please. So he said, yes, and we went along. And I said, stop at a drugstore on the way, because I wanted to look up a telephone number. Now, I had this friend in New York who lived in New York and I knew would help me in any way he could when I contacted him. And I couldn't remember his telephone number, of course. And I knew if I looked it up, I'd find it in the telephone book. So that was why I asked him to stop at a drugstore. I should also say that during the trip, one lunchtime, the stewards who tidied up the tables and took away the blue plate trays that we'd had tapped me on the shoulder and said, that's a nice watch you've got on. It was quite a nice watch. It was not a very expensive one, but it was a good one. And it had a black face, and it looked rather with it in those days. I don't think watches really had black faces very often. And he said, would you like to sell it? So I said, oh, how much do you want? He said, how much would you give me for it? And he said, well, what do you want? And I said, the first thing I could think of, $10, which it was really worth much more than that, of course, I realized afterwards. He said, okay, I'll give you $10 for it. So I sold it for $10, and I had the best part of $10 in my pocket. Otherwise, I would have had no money at all. I had used a dollar or so to pay Ben, the chap who helped me onto the ship, for chocolate bars and things like that he'd bought me in the canteen, which I didn't like to buy myself. I always tried not to talk on the ship because of my English accent sticks out like a sore thumb. And I asked him once or twice to buy me a chocolate bar. So I hadn't quite got $10. So that was the money I had, and here I was sitting in a taxi. He stopped as I asked him at a drugstore, and I looked up the telephone of this friend of mine, John, and then I gave him I looked up the address, of course, I think I've got confused about telephone numbers and addresses. What I wanted was John's address, not his telephone number, but of course it was given in the telephone book. And I looked it up and told him to drive to this address. And when I got there, I got out and I gave him the rest of my money. And I think he must in some way have realized that it was the rest of my money, because he said, "That's not making you short, is it?" And I said, "No, not at all." Because he said, "You don't have to give me..." I think I gave him a couple of dollars tip or something. "You don't have to give me all that extra, you know." So I said, "No, that's all right, that's fine." And he deposited me outside this house and drove off. And I went and rang the bell. No answer. I stood there for about 5 or 10 minutes ringing the bell and realizing there was no answer. And I also realized the date, which was the 31st of August. Now, John was terribly smart, fashionable sort of person, and he would never be in... I realized at this moment he'd never be in New York in August. This is not the time of year when you're in New York if you care about those sort of things. And I thought, heavens, now what do I do? And I started walking around thinking I would... think of somebody else I could look up, but I couldn't think of anybody. Tried to remember some flats or some houses I'd been to before, but it all seemed different. And then there was one of those, what one calls, tropical storms. The heavens just opened up and rain poured down. And in a minute, everybody had left the streets. There was nobody walking around except me. And again, I was thinking, oh, heavens, you know, people are going to say, "Who is this nut who doesn't have anywhere to go when it rains like this?" So I sheltered in one or two doorways, and the rain went on, really pouring down, so that when the drops hit the pavement, they bounced back again, were sort of dancing on the pavement, the rain absolutely soaking. And I only had this jacket that I bought in Finland, no raincoat or anything like that. So I thought, well, I'm going to be picked up sooner or later as a vagrant or something. If I'm not careful, I'll see if I can get into a hotel. And I remembered a hotel I'd stayed at before, once called the New Yorker. And I went up to this hotel and went in and said to the man at the desk, "Have you got a single room, please?" And he said yes and handed me a thing to sign in the normal way. And I thought to myself, let me come clean right now, because it'll be even more suspicious if he finds out I've got no luggage and no money. So I said to him, "I'm sorry, I've lost my luggage, and that means I've also lost my money." And he said, "That'll be quite all right, sir." And I don't know whether it was my English accent or what it was that made him trust me. So I said, "Well, thank you very much. Of course, it'll be all right when I get to a bank," knowing quite well there was no bank I could get to. "And I can't do that now. It's too late. Tomorrow morning I can do that." "Yes, sir, that'll be quite all right." So then I said, well, I'm rather hungry, and could you send me a meal up to my room? And he said, yes, just telephone through for it. So I went up to this room. They gave me a nice, smart room, and I telephoned through for a first really good sort of proper meal, although I'd been eating quite satisfactorily on the American Legion. It wasn't exactly a smart meal. It was eventually wheeled in by the waiter with a red rose in a vase and all the trimmings. And I then asked him, I telephoned through for a copy of The New Yorker and of Fortune and one or two magazines. I thought I may as well be hung for sheep as a lamb. And I went to bed without any pajamas or anything, wondering what would happen in the morning. So far, so good. Next morning, I woke up, and I thought, now, what do I do? So I thought, well, I'll try John again. So I rang John's number, and this time there was an answer. And when I asked for him, the voice said, no, he's upstate, but I can give you his phone number. So I rang him up. They gave me his number, and I rang him up, and I said, I'm here in New York, help. And he said, where are you? And I told him, and he said, well, I'm just on my way to my office. He was working for some Quaker. He's a Quaker, a voluntary organization for prisoners or refugees or something. My office is just around the corner from you. I'll be along in about an hour's time. So that was that, and of course, as soon as I saw him, I said, John, I love you, it's nice to see you, but have you got some money? And he bailed me out and took me up to a place called Katona, New York, where he was spending the summer. And I was right in thinking that he wouldn't spend it in New York City, in Manhattan. And then after about a week, of lazing in his nice house in Katona, I thought, now I've got so far, I must really get on. So I said to John, I'm going, and I'll go up to Canada. That'll be the best way to get home, through Canada. And he said, okay, if that's the way you feel. So I said, yes, I think it's time. I've had a lovely time relaxing here, but now it's time to get back to the war that I'm supposed to be trying to get into. And I said, I don't know how I'll go. And John said, well, I have a friend called Mrs. Roosevelt, not the one you're thinking of, but a cousin or something, and I'm sure she'll help you because she's very pro-British, pro-the Allies, and I'll take you around to see her. So we went around to see Mrs. Kermit Roosevelt, and I told her my story, and she said, well, I think the best thing to do is for me to put you in touch with Dr., and I can't remember his name, Dr. Blank, shall we say, who lives at a town whose name I also forget, but it's virtually the last town in the States before you get to Canada. And he should know how you get across the border. I was, of course, in the situation of having my passport, but not daring show it to anybody, because I'd lied as to who I was, and I shouldn't presumably be getting into Canada on a passport that hadn't got the right stamps on it. So I took the next train up to this place, whose name I can't remember, and got out and went along to the doctor's surgery. And when he called me in to ask what was the matter, I told him, well, nothing was the matter as far as I was concerned medically, and then explained the situation. So he said, no problem. You just get on the train and you go through into Canada. And I said, but won't they ask me for my passport and that kind of thing? He said, just say you're going up for a day's fishing at a place called, I think, Trois-Rivières. And a lot of people go out fishing there. And They'll believe you. I said, but won't they think it funny that I speak obviously as an Englishman and so on? He said, they won't know that. They don't speak much English themselves. They're French there. And all, they won't realize you're speaking as an Englishman and not as an American. So I thought, oh, well, if he says so, that's all right. So I got on the train, and sure enough, after half an hour or so, the Canadian immigration officials came along and asked me for my passport or my papers. And I said, well, I haven't got any. I'm just going fishing at Trois-Rivières. And they said, oh, have you got any papers on you to identify yourself? So I said, oh, yes, they're in my suitcase. I had bought a suitcase to put my shirts and things on, which I'd bought in New York. And they said, all right, you'll show it, show them to us. I couldn't remember what was in my suitcase, but I was just playing for time. And I opened the suitcase, and there on the top were two letters. One letter, which letters of introduction, I should say, which John had given to friends in Canada. And I opened the first one, which said, dear so-and-so, this is to introduce Duncan Guthrie, an English friend of mine. I shut that one up quickly, because, of course, I didn't want it to appear English at this moment, having just said I was American. And I opened the next letter, which was exactly the same, except he hadn't put in the word English. This is to introduce a friend of mine. So I showed this to him. I said, this is all I can find. And the immigration official said, well, that's okay. Have a nice time. And gave me back the letter. And I proceeded up to Montreal. And I got out at Montreal, booked in at a hotel. And the following morning, I went round to a recruiting centre and said, I'm English. Nothing to be worried about now, you see. I'm British. Here's my British passport. And I want to enlist, please. And they said, oh, yes, now what do you enlist in? I said, I want to enlist in the unit that's going overseas first, that's going to England first. And they looked at various papers and said, the first unit going overseas is the Mobile Bath. So I said, okay, Mobile Bath for me. And I joined it. I signed it and swore allegiance to His Majesty and so on. And they said, report back here tomorrow at 11 o'clock. This was a sort of drill hall place that I'd gone to. And following morning, I reported there, but I said, do you think I could go to some other unit than the Mobile Bath? I don't think it's I'd be very good with a bath. And they looked at their papers. There was no security or anything in those very early days of the war. I always said, the next unit going overseas, and it'll go over about the same time, is ACAC, anti-aircraft, Royal Canadian Artillery. So I said, well, could I be in that instead of the bath, please? And they said, all right. And they switched me, and I was then a member of the 5th Light ACAC Battery, Royal Canadian Artillery. And it didn't go as soon as they said, but it went later, about the new year, and by that time the officer commanding the battery knew that I was anxious to get home, and he sent me with an advance guard, so that I left from Halifax just a few days, the beginning of December, and arrived in the Clyde on Christmas Day. And at long last, back again in UK.
Now, I think that you spent some time in the defence of the Scilly Isles. C- Can you tell me how that came about and what conditions were there?
Yes, I stayed in this country, actually very near my home in Sussex, for several weeks, months, several months. And I say that because I eventually got, as we all did, no merit in this, I got a medal for volunteering to join the Canadian Army, and I got a clasp of a maple leaf on it for going overseas, which I always felt slightly ashamed of, because going overseas was coming home. And as I say, I was within a few miles of my own house in Sussex. Well, from time to time, they said to me, I was this time a sergeant, or a bombardier. I think I'd made it to sergeant by then. And they kept on saying to me, we ought to have a commission. Quite frankly, I didn't want a commission. We needn't go into my philosophy about that. I didn't want a commission. And I resisted this.
Maybe you can say what your philosophy about not accepting a commission was.
Beg your pardon?
Can you say what your philosophy about not accepting a commission was?
Oh, not in words that would go here. No, I mean, it's a long thing. And I don't like being a boss. I don't like having to tell people what to do. I don't think I'm probably very good at it. That's why I don't like it, or vice versa. Anyhow, I didn't want to have a commission in the Canadian Army. And then eventually I got a little thing saying I had to go for an interview for an OCTU at Canada House in Trafalgar Square. And at that moment, my commanding officer, or battery commander rather, who knew quite well I didn't want this commission, was on leave. So I couldn't go to him and say, please, sir, you know I don't want this commission. So I thought, oh, well, I'll have to tell him at the board. And I thought, what's the easiest, simplest thing to say? Because I don't rather like now, I don't want to go into my philosophy. I just want a snap answer, which will make sense. So I thought, well, I'll tell them that I don't feel it's right to be an officer and not know the country they came from, and never having been anywhere except Montreal. I won't know their hometown or where it is or anything about it. I won't know anything of the culture of the Canadians and all those sort of things. When you're at one end playing ice hockey, which I've never seen in my life, and all the other things that make up a country's spirit and genius, if you like. So I said, when I was paraded into this board, the colonel, who was obviously chairing it, said, oh, Major so-and-so is going to ask you some questions about being commissioned. So I said, Major so-and-so started collecting his papers together and his pencils and things. And I said, well, I think, sir, if you don't mind, there's been some mistake here because I don't want a commission. I didn't apply for it, and it was done when I was away and so on, and I didn't know anything about it. So the colonel said, the major said, well, why don't you want a commission? So I trotted out my thing about not being a Canadian, having only been in Canada one day before I joined up, not knowing Canada, and so on, which seemed to me a fairly reasonable explanation of why I didn't want a commission. The major was absolutely furious, of course, because I quite saw everybody in turn of the various officers on the board were asking questions of the candidates. And he was having his guns spiked completely as far as showing off what good questions he asked. And that would get him nowhere. So he threw his pencil down and said, well, there's no point in interviewing you, is there, Sergeant? So I said, no, sir, none at all. And was preparing to leave do one of my very smart salutes and leave the room when the colonel said, just a moment. Do you think it really matters if you know the country where the troops come from and so on? So I said, yes, I think it's most important. Yeah, we had this little conversation. So he said, well, the obvious thing to do is to transfer you back to the British Army, or as they used to call it in those days, the Imperial Army, which always struck me as rather odd. Well, that didn't really cheer me up because it didn't get me out of the commission. It reduced my pay by about 50% and it meant I got no free cigarettes, which I used to smoke in those days. Before I knew what had happened, I'd been transferred to the English Army. And that was that. So, Scilly Isles, is that right? Was that
yes,
the question?
Please.
That was the question you asked. It's taken some time to get there,
that's
I'm
all
afraid.
Right. That's all right.
yes, I was. First place I was stationed was on the Scilly Isles. I was posted to the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry, and it was a 30th Battalion. In those days, 30th Battalions were either the old chaps or the chaps who for some reason or other weren't up to joining the other battalions. They were the sort of ragtag and bobtail of every regiment with the 30th Battalions. And there were also people like me, I suppose, who for some reason or other weren't going in the right way. I also said to him that I really didn't care for the thought of going to an OCTU, Officer Cadet Training Unit, which every soldier, every commissioned officer was supposed to have gone through if he wasn't already commissioned. Everybody went to these OCTUs, and I said, I've served as an officer in the Finnish Army, because they knew about that, and I don't really relish going to an OCTU and having to jump around and so on. I think I put it a little better than that. So when I was commissioned, I didn't go to an OCTU. I think I must be the only person in the British Army who didn't go to an OCTU. I went straight down to the 30th Battalion, Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry, on the Isles of Scilly. And that was all right. I enjoyed that for a while. Very relaxed soldiering. No rationing to worry us, because the islands themselves were really too small to be a rationable unit. And we had lots of meat, and we had lots of milk and butter and eggs and those sort of things. Local, of course. I don't think they imported very much, but most of those things were, not the meat perhaps, but most of them were locally grown. And I did a good deal of sort of square bashing, even though I was a second lieutenant. A second lieutenant, I suppose. And then a lieutenant. And it was nice because there was a bit of sailing, a bit of going out to patrol what are called the offshore islands, which is the little islands, uninhabited islands, where there were nice